This is Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thanks for joining us. Today's show is dedicated to our departing and longest-serving producer, Susan Greenbaum. We asked Susan to pick three of her favorite interviews from the Radio Times archive in honor of her last day, and she joins us here in our studio. Susan, nice to have you with us.
Thanks, Marty.
We begin with my interview with Surgeon Amy Goldberg. She's the medical director of the Temple University Hospital Trauma Program. She joined us back in 2007 to tell us about treating people who have been wounded from gun violence and its effects on the victims and their families. Now, Susan, why did you choose this interview?
Well, it seemed to me, Marty, given all the conversation we've had lately about mass shootings and gun control and gun legislation, that what we seem to forget is how gun violence impacts kids and inner city kids. And we listened to this interview again, and it just still resonated.
Well, let's give it a listen. Tell us about some of the patients that you personally, though, have worked on. And you've told really poignant stories of young men often brought into the ER with gunshot wounds. And there you are, a young kid lying on a gurney in front of you and seriously wounded.
Yeah, I specifically remember a case during my trauma fellowship, which I did down in Baltimore, Maryland. What I remember about the case was that it was Sunday evening, You know, an evening where you wouldn't really think that you would see somebody shot. The patient was 16 years of age and was shot in the abdomen or the belly region. And as we were evaluating the patient in the trauma bay, the patient actually lost their blood pressure and pulse. In other words, died right in front of us.
Right.
And those were things that I was trained to take care of. So we opened up his chest and did things to actually get his heart beating again. And we brought him back to the operating room and fixed his injuries. And at that point, he had a very large injury to his aorta, which is the largest artery in the body, and the inferior vena cava, which is the largest vein in the body. And fortunately, we were able to save him. And I remember thinking that this was probably the greatest case that I'll ever do as a trauma surgeon. And then about,
which is bringing someone back to life,
yes,
right?
Yes. And he actually left the hospital fully functional with all of his mental capacities. And when I saw him in our trauma clinic a couple months later, it was like a Thursday in the middle of the afternoon, and I was wondering why he wasn't in school. And then it occurred to me that probably he's not going to be going back to school. And then I was really wondering whether this kid was going to be living until he was 20 or 25 years old. And then all of a sudden, the operation that I had done, which I had thought was so incredible, all of a sudden seemed so insignificant because I wasn't really sure what I was adding to his life.
And do you know what happened to him?
I don't.
You don't?
I don't know.
But he seemed to be a symbol or stand in for a number of victims that you've had to deal with and done surgical interventions on?
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, this is just one of so many that I see and my colleagues see up at Temple of, you know, young kids, you know, 18 into their early 20s, you know, getting shots, sustaining very significant injuries, and then wondering what their place is back in society. Can they get back and finish high school or get their GED? Are they folks that are going to go to college?
Have you noticed a different kind of gunshot wound, I guess, depending on what guns have been available or are popular at the time, for instance?
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, now we're seeing much larger caliber injuries, where maybe back 10 years ago, we were seeing the smaller 22 bullet wounds, and now the wounds are much larger, and we see our fair share of shotgun wounds, which is just, you know, something that I couldn't even imagine seeing in an inner city. I would have thought, you know, shotguns are those things that are used for hunting,
right?
You know, out in western Pennsylvania.
And do you know, how much do you know when someone is brought to the ER, sort of what the nature of their wound is? For instance, do you know if it was a gang-related incident or if it was related to drugs, anything like that?
You know, we don't really know the stories, nor do I find it important to find out.
I was wondering about that.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of don't want to know. It's not my job to know. It's what I'm supposed to do is take care of that patient, regardless of what the circumstance of the shootings were. If you're trying to get a story when the patients come in, it's probably not going to be the right story. So I really just want to take care of the patients that's there on the operating room table or there in the trauma bay to do my best to take care of them.
What about after surgery and they're now in post-op, they're recovering? What kind of conversations have you had with some of these young people?
I feel as part of my routine postoperative care, as I would, you know, look at their incisions or remove some of their tubes, I feel it is my responsibility to have some conversation with them about the simplicity of, do you understand that this wound almost killed you?
Do they? Do they understand that?
You know, I think they surely do when they first come in. When they come in, they're very frightened, totally understandable, very frightened that they're going to die, and always say, you know, many of them say, am I going to die? Am I going to die? You know, and then, you know, unfortunately, a few days post-op, they seem to forget that and get tough again and almost fearless again. And I think it's at that point that I need to remind them that they could have died from this wound. And just because they narrowly escaped doesn't mean the next time that they will again.
Do you have to then figure out how to penetrate whatever that either wall of denial or some kind of defense that goes up after they begin to recover? As you say, they come in frightened, thinking they're going to die.
Yeah, I mean, they you know, many of the patients get tough again, and maybe that's what they need to do. I you know, and I surely don't want to pass judgment, because that would be terrible. I have no idea what the circumstances of the shootings are. But I can only do my best to try to explain to them and educate them that they were fortunate. And if they get shot again, not only will it make it much more difficult technically for us to take care of them if we have to go operate in that same area because of scarring, but that they really may not be so lucky again.
Is there any way to know whether they get that message? Can you see when you're talking with them whether they understand what you're saying?
For some of the patients, you can definitely tell, and they may say to you, you know, I'm going to maybe move out of Philadelphia.
Is that something that
Yes.
you've heard?
Yes. You know, I have
someplace safer.
Yes. You know, I have to leave the city. Or, yes, doc, I understand. And I think it's the city's I think somehow the city has to help these folks stay in Philadelphia and be able to not feel as though their lives are threatened on a daily basis.
You and Scott Charles, who's been a guest on Radio Times in the past, outreach coordinator at Temple University, started a program called Cradle to Grave. Tell us about the program and tell us why you wanted to start it.
Cradle to Grave began back in about February 2006 when we first started bringing kids in to the hospital. And what the program is it's a story tells kind of the life and an unfortunate death of a 16-year-old boy who was shot nearly 20 times within a few blocks of Temple University Hospital.
And this is a real case?
Yes, it is. And this was a case that Scott had been studying with the Grover Washington Middle School when he had been working with Need and Deed. We go through the path that Lamont followed when he came to Temple and some of the procedures that went on in the trauma bay. And then we take the kids from the schools down to a classroom, and we just kind of define what is trauma and what goes on when you get shot, so that we can explain to them and show them that it isn't what they're hearing on the radio, on hip hop, or in video games, or what they see on TV. That actually, when people get shot, they can die.
But that's so interesting, because in certain neighborhoods in this city, there are, according to the people who live there, you know, sound of gunshots almost every night. And that death is a very present experience for so many kids in this city. And yet you say they haven't quite connected all the dots.
Yes, I mean, you're absolutely right in that many of the patients that we see have either been shot before themselves or know of people that have been shot before. Some of the kids that come to our program, also, the majority of them, unfortunately, know of people that have been shot before. And I'm not sure, you know, if somebody in the neighborhood gets shot through the thigh and they do just fine, you know, that's a wonderful thing. But I think then that just reinforces to them, well, you know what, you know, I'm going to live if I get shot. And that's what I see in my neighborhood. And that's what I see on hip hop. And that's what I see in the movies and on video.
And in part, that's what you do, right?
Yeah, we hope.
You fix people and send them back out on their way.
Absolutely. So I think our cradle to grave is to give them a realistic view of what trauma is and what really goes on in the trauma bay, and provide an education for them that if people want and if these kids want to go down that path, well, they should at least have all the facts before they decide, you know what, I'm going to carry a gun or I'm going to be impulsive one day on the street. So I think the program provides the kids the education as this really is what trauma is. This is what happens when you get shot. Or when you get stabbed. And then I think that we like to show them that there are other ways of dealing with either aggressiveness on the streets or arguments on the streets, that you don't need to be impulsive, that it's okay to walk away, that that may be the best decision that you ever make in your life.
This does include a trip to the morgue?
Yes, it does. And Scott always loves to say you can be a temple in one of three ways. You can come as a patient, which we don't want you. You could come as a visitor, which we also wouldn't want you. Or maybe you can come to work, which would be fantastic. And that's really the message that we want to give these young kids.
And we also hear that many of these incidents are based on an argument, a disagreement, someone disrespected somebody else. And from an outside perspective, it seems totally nonsensical. Why would you shoot somebody over a disagreement about something?
And Scott starts talking to the kids about, well, who would you give up your life for? Who would you die for? It's incredibly moving.
Right.
And most of the folks that the kids say are, you know, my mom or my dad or my brother. And then Scott makes the point that most of the people that the youth are now dying for on the streets aren't these people. It's strangers that really don't care anything about them.
Do you think that's part of the problem, is these kids don't feel cared about, loved in the way that children want to be loved?
No, I mean, I think their families, their parents, I mean, I do think that they have probably some support systems and that they are feeling love, but I think they're giving up their lives for an impulsive moment on the street.
Again, that was my interview with medical director of the Temple University Hospital Trauma Program, Amy Goldberg, recorded back in 2007. You're listening to Radio Times in Review. When we get back from the break, we'll hear another one of our departing producer Susan Greenbaum's favorite interviews, Nigerian-born author Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We're devoting today's show to the favorite Radio Times interviews of our departing producer, Susan Greenbaum. We're now listening to my interview with Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, the Nigerian-born award-winning author who joined us back in 2009. She had just published her book, The Thing Around Your Neck, and had also just won a MacArthur Award. Now, Susan, why did you pick this interview?
She is just such a beautiful writer, and I was introduced to her work by my daughter. And then I went on to read her other books and a lot of other African writers. And she writes about not only life in Africa, but the immigrant experience in the United States, and tells us a lot about ourselves. And I love listening to her voice.
Well, let's give it a listen. You told the Financial Times, and I'm quoting here, "My writing comes from a place of deep dissatisfaction within me." Do you write to deal with that dissatisfaction, to understand it?
Yeah, the thing about giving interviews is that you say things that come back to haunt you.
And it's just come back to haunt you.
Yes, so many other things have. And sometimes, you know, I say things, I'm exhausted, I'm sleep deprived. But I do think that my writing is about, and I think a lot of writing for many people, that it comes from a place of of dissatisfaction, of wishing that things were different, of
And writing maybe to, if not to make them right, at least to understand what causes that.
And to ask questions, you know. I think for me, a lot of my work is not about giving answers because I don't know the answers. Mm-hmm. Because for me, sometimes the process of writing is to seek, to understand, and in the end, I don't necessarily understand.
One of your characters in one of your stories, although says that writing is not therapy, and I wonder if that's also true for you.
I think that word therapy, I find myself wanting to run away from it. But
the word itself?
Yes.
And what it implies?
The baggage that it carries. But I think it depends on how one defines therapy. If therapy is something that you can't... For me, the idea of life without writing is unbearable. Mm. And if that's what therapy is, then maybe...
You began writing as a little girl?
Yes, I've been writing since I was old enough to spell. And I imagined I was a writer when I was 7.
And you wrote about what kinds of things as a little girl?
I wrote, because I was reading, I was also quite an early reader. And I was reading a lot of, I grew up in a small university town in eastern Nigeria, very sort of secluded. The kind of place where if you took out the university campus, it was just a collection of houses and trees. And I was reading a lot of British children's books. So when I started to write, I was writing what I was reading. Mm. So I had characters who were playing in the snow, and I had never seen snow. And I had characters who ate apples, and I don't think I'd ever tasted an apple at the time. So this was the beginning of my storytelling.
But it tells us something about your imagination, doesn't it?
I think it does, and also about the power, I think, of books, of what when you're particularly as a child, that just the power of it.
You grew up, and I know you've been asked this a lot, but I just found that this coincidence is, it's wonderful. It's strange. You grew up in the house where Chinua Achebe lived, and he, of course, wrote the very famous novel Things Fall Apart. And do you think in some way his presence in that house helped to make you a writer?
Well, no, not really. I mean, I like to talk about waking up at night to go to the bathroom and hearing the literary spirits whispering in my ears. But no, because I was writing. I mean, we moved into that house when I was, 8 or 9, and I was already sort of a scribbling child. And it's a coincidence that's interesting, but when you really think about how small a community the academic sort of world was in eastern Nigeria, it isn't that surprising. And so we all lived in university housing on the campus, and a family would move out, another family would move in. And, you know, my family happened to move in just after that Chebet had moved out.
Did he, though, help to make you a writer, even if you hadn't lived in his house?
I think I sense that I'm doing what I was meant to be doing. I think that I would have been doing this anyway.
Was your, and do you find people in Nigeria then, that the image of America still is, you know, the big car, the big house, and the guns, as this character talks about?
I mean, I find that America is one of the interesting things about in Nigeria, which is a place that is incredibly religious. In the South, it's, you know, sort of increasingly fundamentalist Christian. In the North, increasingly fundamentalist Muslim. And I'm familiar with the South. And you find that in the churches, people have special prayer sessions to get American visas.
Oh, really?
I mean, the idea of America is so pervasive in people's minds. Young people graduate from school, and what do they want? They want to get an American visa. And the idea of America as the other that's perfect, still.
Still, inspired.
Very much.
The news filters around the world, images, I mean, there are no sort of actual borders anymore.
No, they aren't. And I think also that the sort of the cultural dominance that America has everywhere in the world means that on the one hand, I mean, for example, under the Bush administration, so people on the one hand sort of didn't like things like, oh, Americans are not doing such good things in Iraq. But then on the other hand, they love Jay-Z and they watch American movies and they have bought into the idea of, you know, life is the Cosby Show sort of thing. And they want America. It's incredible to me how sort of the ordinary Nigerian just absolutely adores everything American.
Huh. Was that true for you growing up? I mean, you grew up in a university town.
I did.
Your parents worked for a university. Your father was a professor. And
yes. And I think because I grew up in circles that were... I mean, as a child, I remember that we... And in some ways, this might also have been a reaction to sort of our colonial past, that we didn't want to watch British films as children. So if somebody brought a video home and it was a British film, you know, you just thought, no, we're not interested. But an American film, yes.
Oh, is that right? Right.
But I think as an older sort of, when I got older and hopefully wiser, I think also I sort of had friends who, you know, self-styled intellectual types who had read history and who, you know, didn't sort of love America as easily as the more, you know, sort of the people who didn't know as much history. So I have friends who, for example, might argue about America's imperial policies and that sort of thing. So I think as I got older, my affection became more complicated.
Well, I think it's important to have a complicated affection for wherever one lives. But interestingly, as you said, many people didn't want to have anything to do with British culture. Mm. But as a little girl, you read these British books, mm. right? In the Snow and Apples and all of that.
Yes, yes.
Is that just because those were the books around? Or
yes, those were really the books that were easy to find. I read some American books as well, but sort of starting up at 6 and 7. I remember in kindergarten we had, and I suppose some foundation in London might have sent the books or something, but we did have quite a number of British books. And I think also just the idea that there's so many connections between Nigeria and England, so that the spellings are the same, and there are some things that are familiar. So in some ways I was immersed in Anglophilia when I was a child, but I'm happy to announce I have since completely let go of all of that.
Now, you studied medicine for a while, right, at the University of Nigeria?
I did.
With the thought of being a doctor?
Yes, because you do well in school, they tell you you have to be a doctor. So I sort of went along with that just for a year and a half until I realized that I would be very unhappy.
Why?
Because I didn't care enough. I passed the exams perfectly, but I didn't care. And I felt that you have to care to do that. You have to care to become a doctor. I had planned to be a psychiatrist and to mine the lives of my patients for writing material. But I realized that the 6 or 7 years that it would take to actually get to being a doctor wasn't, I just didn't want to.
And it's a huge commitment. And it sounds also, like you said, even as a little girl, you knew you wanted to be a writer.
I did. And going on to study medicine was really just to sort of, in many ways, to fulfill other people's expectations and then to write. But 1 year in, I realized I can't even, I just will be desperately unhappy. And, you know, life is short. And
I read you were a very good student. I'm looking at something from The Independent in London from a couple of months ago. Her grades were all A's, but the teacher's remarks gave her parents headaches. She's stubborn, arrogant. She has no respect, wrote one, after she was told that he was wrong about something. I remember being very angry with my father, being very angry with the teacher, just feeling the sense of injustice that I hadn't been allowed to speak. You were one of those kids in class that stood up and asked questions.
I was one of those really annoying, extremely annoying children. But I think my parents did fairly well at raising me to believe in politeness and graciousness, and I do. I think it's important. But I was also struck growing up at the idea of the adult knows it all and the child just shuts up. And so in school, I would often sort of say to my form master or something, you know, excuse me, but that's not quite. And then he would be horrified. How dare you speak? Mm. So it was the act itself of even trying to speak that was considered sort of rude.
Is that why you write, in a way? Because, I mean, it's a way of speaking, isn't it?
Yeah, I suppose so. But I'm also, I mean, my parents weren't like that. So we were allowed to speak at home and allowed to disagree. And we often did. And something I feel very grateful for now. But generally, I mean, I think that the cultural idea was that the children just shut up.
But, you know, I don't want to make too much of this, but I have to say that a lot of the men and even the boys in these stories are in many ways irresponsible, unreliable, sometimes dictatorial. They don't come across real well. And this book is dedicated to, as you said, the man you love.
I feel like I have to defend my affection for men, which is great. I like men. But I'm also very much, I self-define as a happy feminist. And I am interested in gender. And I do think that I come from a world in which I've observed that it's just often more difficult for women. Women have to make more compromises often in so many different situations, and it's something I'm very interested in a sort of very personal way. But also, it's not that I'm interested in men as bad people. It's that I'm interested in a power structure that just benefits men, and so in some ways it's disappointing to hear, but I think there are also men characters who are redeeming and who are, you know. And on the other hand, I think there are women. I mean, I'm also quite interested in how I go back to Lagos, for example, and talk about gender, which I do quite often. And I find that sometimes the people who resist, with the people with whom I argue the most are women. It's women who say to me, oh, don't say that because you have to be submissive to men. You know, it's women who... So for me, it's also quite interesting to talk about sort of intra-gender. You know, that there are women who are accomplished and educated, but who still believe, for example, that, you know, you should be submissive.
Do you find it's a different conversation in Nigeria than you have in the United States about some of these issues?
It's different, but there are many similarities. They just manifest themselves in different ways. I mean, I'm surprised that some of the things that my female American friends will agree with or do or say, and I just think it's dangerous for women.
Such as
the idea that recently a friend of mine said she got engaged and she said she needed him to give her a present. And I said, and by the way, she has a job, she earns more than he does. And I said, well, why should he? I mean, the idea that marriage is somehow, I think there's a sense in which marriage has become understood as ownership that involves the woman in a way that it doesn't involve the man. Hmm. And I thought I felt really uncomfortable with the idea that she expected a present from a man who ostensibly is her best friend and her equal partner because they were engaged, but she wouldn't give him a present. He had to give her a present. And I just thought, I just didn't like that very much.
I mean, what you're saying is how, I guess, women implicate themselves in this. I mean, you can call it patriarchy, you can call it other
things
as well.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I mean, and also on the one hand that there's talk of equality and believing in it. And also, I mean, I recognize the ways in which men and women are different. I mean, I'm not at all saying we're the same because we're not. We have different hormones, and I think that really affects things. But I think it's the ways in which women have come to accept. And on the one hand, we talk about equality. But then on the other hand, we sort of still buy into ideas of, you know, he gets down on his knees and brings out a ring and you're supposed to gasp in surprise and gratitude. I have a problem with that.
Because you were born in Nigeria, which is a country. I mean, you know, I shouldn't have to tell you this. But this idea that you have to speak for not just a country, but for a continent.
Yes.
As if there weren't diverse countries, opinions, yes, histories, all within this one continent.
Yeah. I remember when I came to the U.S. and I was somehow expected to be, I was African.
Exactly.
And, you know, I thought I know nothing about Namibia. I have no clue about even, you know, Congo. I think also that in addition to that, but in some ways there is such a thing as Africa, particularly sub-Saharan Africa. And I think that there are things that I go to Kenya and there are things that are familiar to me. But I think for me what I find very... disturbing is the idea that Africa has come to mean certain things in many people's minds, and that I really want us to be aware of the many multiple stories of the diversity of not just ethnicity but class. I mean, people often talk about, you know, tribal hate and all of that, which I mostly find amusing, and I find that class differences in sub-Saharan Africa are huge. And often much more important, I think, than ethnic differences. But we never sort of talk about that because Africa is a place of, you know, the monolithic poverty and everybody's waiting for the kind Westerner to come save them or adopt them.
A class based on education.
Mostly.
Money, but yes. Education largely.
Yes. Yes, there are countries that have had sort of long histories of aristocracies, and my region in Nigeria isn't one because my ethnic group was sort of largely Republican. So what's happened now is that when Western education came, it became the basis for class differentiation and money. I mean, Nigeria is becoming horribly materialistic in ways that I find disturbing. That also has created gulfs between people. And you find that people who have a lot, despite the ethnic backgrounds, have things in common.
Oh, interesting.
And it's just something that I don't think that we engage with enough, and that often the coverage of Africa from the outside also doesn't engage with that.
We don't have time for a story, but you do have a wonderful story in the book, which is based in part on your great-grandmother, who just... refused to behave, so to speak.
Yeah. She was this wonderfully fierce woman who my father says was often described as headstrong and troublemaker, and who I just found incredibly inspiring because I remember saying to my father that what some people thought of as headstrong and stubborn was simply a woman who was strong-willed and spoke her mind. Mm-hmm. And if she had been male, she would have been described as strong and tough and admirable.
And also like a first grader that would challenge or question the teacher, right?
Yes.
Part
yes.
of this female tradition within your family. Did you grow up with stories about the war? And I think for at least some Americans, this was an image of Africa, perhaps an image that endures today about starving
yes.
people.
Yes, absolutely. I think actually think that the image of the starving African child started in Biafra. Biafra was the first war that was widely televised, and, you know, Life magazine had the Biafran cover. And it's still, I mean, I've had so many stories in promoting the novel from different parts of the world where people were told, eat your food, the starving children in Biafra. And I think that image has endured.
Yes,
but we've come to see, we think Africa and we think the starving child.
But do you also think that your generation of writer, maybe even from Nigeria, is still grappling with the effects of this particular war, which of course goes back several decades?
I think maybe not. I mean, I think I am in particular. For some reason, I've just been so oddly haunted by that period. I think in general, I'm haunted by history. I mean, I have other contemporary writers from Nigeria who are much more interested in sort of in our present. I find that in this sort of crazy old-fashioned way, I keep looking back.
And there's a lot to look back at, isn't
there? There is. And there's also a lot that hasn't been talked about, I don't think. And the war, for example, since it ended, there's sort of been a formal and formalized silence around it. We don't learn about it in school. Nobody really talks about it. And maybe that's also why I became even more obsessed with wanting to understand.
That was my 2009 interview with writer Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. You're listening to Radio Times in Review. After the break, we'll listen to my 2003 interview with acclaimed author and illustrator Mori Sendak. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We're saying goodbye to Radio Times' longest-serving producer, Susan Greenbaum, today, and we've asked her to pick some of her favorite interviews from the Radio Times archives. And finally, we'll hear my 2003 interview with author and illustrator Mori Sendak, most famous for his seminal work, Where the Wild Things Are. I'm crying, Susan. Why this interview?
Well, like so many parents, I spent countless bedtimes reading this story to my children. And it was interesting, in doing the research for his visit, I noticed that he had illustrated a book I had been given when I was 4 years old. And it was one of his earliest works. And I brought it in to the studio, and he was beaming. And he asked me if he could sign it. And I still cherish that copy. It was a very loved book from my childhood. And I loved hearing you growl in this interview.
I did get to growl. One of my favorite interviews as well, and one of my favorite books. Let's give it a listen. So what books were you read as a kid?
I wasn't read books. I was told stories by my father, me, my brother, sister. We all shared a room. And my father told us stories in Yiddish about the old country. And they were terrifying, and he did not know what was appropriate for children. Thus, I never learned what was appropriate for children. And often, I would repeat his stories in the classroom because they were so terrific.
In English, of course.
In English. A quick, rough translation. And I was sent home. I remember once, maybe only once, sent home to have my mouth washed out because I told such a weird, erotic. I didn't know it was erotic. And I was scolded. We didn't literally have books. My sister had books because she was the eldest. And I so envied her because she belonged to the Book of the Month Club. And a book would come for her. And it drove me crazy. I've never forgiven her.
I read a quote somewhere that you said, to me, the Grimm's tales were an extension of the stories my father told me. Mm-hmm. They're very like his stories in which people got hacked and eaten and brutalized, and the bad people were really tortured to death. And that was such a great satisfaction.
Yeah, it caused a little insomnia, no big deal.
So as a kid, were you drawing? Were you doodling, making pictures?
Yeah, it was like family business. My father was telling stories. My brother, who was immensely gifted, he's gone now, unfortunately, but he was 5 years older than me, was writing stories and illustrating stories, and I just automatically became apprenticed to him. So there was nothing else I could do. It seemed like there was nothing else he could do. And that was the best part of childhood. I had to be indoors a lot of the time, writing and drawing and tracing the comics on the window. You know, hold it up to the window and you trace them. And that's a very happy memory.
So you're largely self-taught as a...
Totally self-taught.
Did anyone ever try to teach you in school?
Yeah.
No, unsuccessful?
No go. I was very unhappy in school. Very unhappy. I mean, you might use words now, which I don't know would genuinely apply, like dyslexia. I was a left-handed kid, so I had to sit in the back of the room with my arm belted. And only when I improved could I move up a seat, because in the back of the room were the dumbbells. I hated school. And even past the early grades, where you could begin to defend yourself a little bit, it just never worked. So that the teachers who were concerned and interested in me, I had total mistrust. So I never thought I'd get out, and I almost didn't. I mean, I just failing in everything.
So they turn you into a right-handed person by tying your left hand?
Well, they turned me into a right-handed person, a stammerer. But now I'm ambidextrous. I can only do things with left hand, and when I get tired painting with the right, I move the brush to the left. So, see, like a television movie of the week, it all worked out nice.
Well, I do want to talk a little bit about Where the Wild Things Are. I read that the inspiration for the wild things in your book were these ants who used to come on Sunday afternoons to the family, I guess, for dinner.
Yeah, well,
social gathering.
Every Sunday, aunts and uncles. These are people my parents had brought over from the old country. But, you know, I didn't quite understand that as a child. I couldn't fathom why they gibbered in a foreign language, why they ate our food, why didn't they go to somebody else's house. I had no sympathy for them whatsoever. And like all children do, I focused on, like, the yellow eyeballs. Mm-hmm. And one uncle had long hairs coming out of his nose, and I didn't like them.
Did they reach down and
of course they
pinched your cheek.
And my mother was a slow cooker, and they would say things like, I could eat you up, and I knew they would. So I'd never say that to children. I never say that, because children are so literal-minded. So I sympathized with them only in adulthood when I realized what their suffering had been all about. And they were the inspiration.
Yeah. And Max, this mischievous little boy who gets sent to his room for being a mischievous little mm-hmm. boy, was that drawn from your own life, kids that you knew from, or just...
No, it was drawn really from an idealization of what I thought a perfect family relationship is. That was not my case. I wouldn't have had the guts to stand up like he did. Mm. No, to me it was... I was amazed when the book came out. There were so many complaints about... Like Bruno Bettelheim wrote a long article about how this book was really bad for children. And
really? Who loves fairy tales, or loved fairy tales.
Yeah, well, turned out he wasn't quite such a super-duper guy, sadly, what we discovered. Anyway, he felt that it was such an un-American thing to send your child to bed without feeding him. Terrible that the child defied the mother and said, I'll eat you up. Horrifying that she got mad back. Hmm. Now, what he seemed to have missed entirely, that this was a relationship which had proven itself, where he knew he could say that, and she knew she could get mad too, and they loved each other. So that could happen, and it would happen like every Tuesday or Wednesday until he's about 35 anyway.
Exactly. Well, I'd love to have you read Where the Wild Things
okay.
Are for us.
As I said before, there are three spreads without words. So you're going to have to come in.
Okay.
The night Max wore his wolf suit and made mischief of one kind and another, his mother called him Wild Thing, and Max said, I'll eat you up. So he was sent to bed without eating anything. That very night, in Max's room, a forest grew until his ceiling hung with vines and the walls became the world all around. And an ocean tumbled by with a private boat for Max, and he sailed off through night and day and in and out of weeks and almost over a year to where the wild things are. And when he came to the place where the wild things are, They roar their terrible roars and gnash their terrible teeth and roll their terrible eyes and show their terrible claws till Max said, "Be still," and tamed them with the magic trick of staring into all their yellow eyes without blinking once, and they were frightened and called him the most wild thing of all and made him king of all wild things. "And now," cried Max, "let the wild rumpus start." "Now stop," Max said, and sent the wild things off to bed without their supper. And Max, the king of all wild things, was lonely and wanted to be where someone loved him best of all. Then all around, from far away across the world, he smelled good things to eat. So he gave up being king of where the wild things are. But the wild things cried, "Oh, please don't go. We'll eat you up. We love you so." And Max said, "No." The wild things roar their terrible roars and gnash their terrible teeth and roll their terrible eyes and show their terrible claws. But Max stepped into his private boat and waved goodbye and sailed back over a year and in and out of weeks and through a day and into the night of his very own room, where he found his supper waiting for him. And it was still hot.
Maurice Sendak, reading a book he wrote and illustrated 40 years ago called Where the Wild Things Are. And you're right, it has to be hot. It can't be warm.
I think they worried about the hot because then he would hurt his lips if he sipped hot soup without getting the point of it, that, as you pointed out, warm soup means been standing around for God knows how long.
Exactly, and a kid would know that.
Absolutely. So she would have loved him less by bringing the soup in too soon.
Well, tell me about when he tamed them with the magic trick of staring into their yellow eyes without blinking once. Was that a magic trick that you did as a kid?
That's what we played in the street. The first person who blinked lost.
Ah.
So it was a blinking game, a staring game.
Were you good at it?
No. I don't recollect being champion. But you had to invent all kinds of easy games because you couldn't cross the street without your mother sitting up there by the window, supervising your crossing. It was not called a street in Brooklyn. It was called the gutter.
The gutter.
Yes. If you wanted to cross the gutter, you had to yell for your mother. She came to the window and she watched you. Because you did it without her watching you, you would definitely die.
Because she told you so,
she
right?
She absolutely said, "You'll get killed." I believed her.
I was going to say, and it sounds like you believed her.
Yes.
Well, if Where the Wild Things Got You in Trouble in the Night Kitchen, I guess only reinforced that.
Oh,
because
yeah.
You have this little boy, Mickey. He falls out of bed into a vat of cake batter, and part of what we see as he falls through the bottle of milk is
right.
His little penis.
His little penis, little boy. That got in terrible trouble because apparently I had broken another taboo, which was that there was never had been, I was astonished, frontal nudity. Now, they draw little girls, but sadly that's okay. And I was so angry that I did a book after that called The Light Princess, a fairy tale by George MacDonald.
Mm.
She literally is light. She floats, and she also is empty-headed. And I drew her as a child floating out the window with her genitalia fully exposed and drawn with such precision I almost went cross-eyed. And it was never, ever mentioned.
Mm.
Whereas Mickey, with his little penis swimming in milk, caused an eruption of rage. How dare I do this? It was banned from libraries. It still is in many libraries, and it's only allowed in libraries if the teacher, or the kindergarten teacher, whatever, takes a magic marker and covers him.
Covers Mickey.
And I've had many copies sent to me by outraged librarians who are on my side, and they're the kinkiest things you've ever seen. Like, what goes on in the minds of some of these people? He was wearing jock straps. He was wearing thongs. We shall go no further.
Yeah.
Yeah. That infuriated me. The criticism of Wild Things was, well, you could look at it any way you like, but I thought, what's wrong with this country?
Mm-hmm.
you know, that we, and why make little boys feel like this is a shameful, sinful thing? Because all you did was have kids holding up the books to the light in the library to see what was covered up so that they really focused on what these people did not want them to focus on. That was a bad look for me into society.
Do you think it is better today?
No.
Although, as you say, this book is still covered up or glued together.
It's become well known and it's become a favorite of many people, but I don't know that it's changed anything. Mm-hmm. I don't know. No, why do I don't know? I know things have been changed.
I mean, it's not even about sexuality so much. I mean, it's just about an organ.
Well, also, it's about sensuality, the milk, the dough, the stuff of touching and feeling, the pleasures that children have in their bodies. And I'm saying, congratulations, kid, you got a great body. And that turned into sinister stuff that's puritanical and frightful. And a book is a sensuous side. When I design a book, I want the cover to feel a certain way, the paper, the binding, the spine, because reading, living, is a sensuous business. Everything we do comes from our sexual cells, our soul cells, our intellectual cells. What is this barbaric stuff of cutting that part out of our lives? I don't know the answer.
But do you feel that you've had to crusade against this, or you just do what you do?
I just do what I do.
And let the world react?
I just do what I do. I'm not going to crusade against something so fatuous and ignorant. That's not what I do. I got my job to do.
Let me ask you a little bit about how you work, or how you, if you have a studio, is it messy? Is it noisy? What is it like?
It's beautiful.
Beautiful.
I have a lovely house in Connecticut, and my studio is part of an old barn that was attached to the house many years ago. And the views are sumptuous. It's cherry trees, it's grass, it's trees, it's the whole bit. It's totally messy. But there is, and I think a lot of artists will agree, there is an order to the mess. So God help me when somebody takes it into their head to clean the studio. I'm done. I know that broken pencil is the only one I want to do with a picture with, so I leave it hanging. Take it away, kaput. Now, I'll soon be finished with some major projects I've been on for some years, and what I can't wait for is the end of a long project so I can throw everything out and clean my studio and find mail that was a year ago that should have been urgently answered. But the mess is an important way of handling the material that you're working on. And your head is a mess. It's all chaos in your brain, and the studio has to kind of look like what you're walking into. So it's a nice mess.
Yeah, and you have a kind of a single mind. If you're working on a project, that's all that consumes your imagination, your
all
time.
That consumes. And my day is like in the barracks. Every day is repeated exactly the same way because there's no other way to get the work done. Huh. And if you wait for the muse to enter your life, I mean, God knows what she's doing. She's at some club on Broadway. Then your life is over.
That was my 2003 interview with Maury Sendak. So now we say goodbye to Radio Times producer Susan Greenbaum. She began 16 years ago as a volunteer, and it was clear from the start that she was and is a natural-born producer. She's dogged, curious, laser-focused, passionate, organized, collaborative, and so much fun to work with. What a combination. She's been a great friend and support to me and the producers who have worked with her over the years. The good news is that Susan will be filling in from time to time, so we will still have the benefit of her many talents. We will, though, still miss her. Thank you, Susan, for 16 amazing years. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen.